Welcome, listeners, to another spine-chilling episode of Beyond the Unknown. I'm your host, Jolie.
And I'm Quinn.
And today, we're diving deep into the sordid tale of a business partnership that went terribly wrong. 44-year-old Gary McGrath went missing on February 7, 2004, and in 2006, his remains were found deep in a hole on a property in Alberta. Who was Gary? How did his body end up in Alberta? And who put him there?
Dun dun dun. Originally a fisherman from Conch, Newfoundland, Gary McGrath and his wife and four children moved to Alberta in the 1970s. Then, and perhaps still now, employment in Newfoundland was scarce. And when the fishing industry dried up, all hope was lost. Making a decent living to feed a family proved basically impossible. So like many others before him, and many after him, he made the western trek to Alberta, Canada, in search of greener pastures. Alberta has a notorious history of drawing people in from all over Canada in search of employment, with a prosperous economy thanks to the oil industry. While in Alberta, McGrath befriended a man 10 years his senior called George William Allen. Eventually, the two opened a truck shop together near Edmonton. McGrath was clearly a motivated individual who wanted to provide for his family, so to further earn more cash on the side, he operated a firewood business. This firewood business, however, was housed on Allen's property in Antler Lake, just east of Edmonton. McGrath would pay rent to Allen in order to use part of the property for storage. Despite a 10-year-long friendship, things started to turn sour between the two, and tensions began to rise. Allen claimed that McGrath had not been owning up to his end of the bargain, and in terms of rent payment, owed him over $24,000.
That's a lot. Like, how long was he renting? What was the rent?
I don't know. So I tried to dig deeper into actually, like, where their truck shop was, because rumor has it was somewhere in Sherwood Park, which is just a small town just east of Edmonton. I couldn't find any details on what they actually owned, and then that, the how much rent he was owing, and, like, was he actually chopping trees off of his property or was he literally just storing wood? I have no idea.
Because that seems like a lot of money. So it's like, was he not paying him for years?
As you'll start to get to know Allen as things go on, part of me thinks that this was just some number he like cocked up in his head.
Okay.
Yeah. On February 7th, 2004, the two planned to meet in the shop on Allen's property to discuss the matter in person. Later that day, McGrath called his family to let him know that he was on his way home, but he never showed up. The days following his disappearance involved a frantic search to discover his whereabouts, but there was absolutely no sign of him. Allen claimed he had not seen him since he left his property on the 7th. The search continued. His West and East Coast families frantically looked for him, but it seems like he disappeared in plain sight. 10 days later, his Dodge pickup truck was found abandoned in the West Edmonton Mall parking lot. For those of you who don't know, the West Edmonton Mall is, I think, the second biggest mall in North America. I think the first biggest is America Mall or...
Oh, Mall of America in Minnesota.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I think that takes the cake for the biggest, but this one's pretty huge. It's got like theme park, a water park, this giant pirate ship. There at one point was a huge zoo, but now there's just sea lions.
There's a skating rink.
Yeah, skating rink, like a full size. Every store you could ever imagine.
Multiple food courts.
Yeah, it's huge. I can't remember how many city blocks they said it was, but so the parking lot around it is massive. So to have actually found his truck in that parking lot is, I don't even know how you would make that discovery. The family had a strong suspicion that the business partner, Allen, might have been involved in McGrath's disappearance, or at least have a better idea of his whereabouts than he let on. If you recall, Allen just said that the last time he saw him was on February 7th after he left. The RCMP searched Allen's property, including the shop where they met, and found no traces of McGrath, no suspicious things like blood, and the shop appeared really clean and kind of immaculate for a shop if you've ever been in a rural Albertan farm shop. They're pretty messy. In the 24 months that followed, the family was starting to feel hopeless. They felt completely let down by law enforcement. In this instance, the case was being overseen by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, If you've listened to our podcast before, you've heard us talk about the RCMP many times. But if you don't know, this is the main police detachment that operates on a federal basis across the nation, mostly serving all the rural towns that don't have their own city police. The family felt as though the RCMP was not making enough effort or giving the case adequate attention. They always just felt kind of brushed off. McGrath's family started looking at every single way humanly possible to track down their beloved son, husband, brother, and father. They used any means necessary, including contacting a psychic. When I first read that they contacted a psychic, I was like, huh? But honestly, if someone I loved went missing, oh man, the things that I wouldn't do, I would probably do that too.
Yeah, same here.
Apparently, though, the RCMP weren't too thrilled with some of the actions of the family, including their attempts to contact Alan. Although confusing and pretty frustrating for the family, it would later become pretty clear just why the RCMP wanted the family to back off.
Okay.
As it turns out, the RCMP were up to something. It was not until October 2006 when McGrath's body was finally found. It was found wrapped in plastic and buried deep in a hole drilled on a property near Edmonton in Antler Lake. And, surprise, surprise, this is the property of his business partner, George William Allen.
Fishy.
Yeah, no surprise there. So, how did the RCMP do it? How did they finally figure it out? When the family thought the RCMP was doing nothing, Alan was actually secretly under surveillance by law enforcement for quite some time following McGrath's disappearance. Turns out he was a shady fella in general. Couldn't find out too much of the other shady things he was doing, which is so weird, but he was kind of sketchy anyways. And undercover RCMP officers posing as members of a well-known crime group involved in poaching and other illegal activities.
Poaching what?
Like animals and stuff.
Just like illegal hunting?
Yep, there's a lot of that here. So if you have Indigenous, Métis status, that kind of thing, you can pretty much hunt wherever at any time of year. But if you don't, you're very much restricted in geographical location and time of year and which animals and the number of animals and all kinds of stuff. Somehow, the RCMP managed to gain Alan's confidence over time while they were posing as this crime gang. Then finally, while being recorded, Alan confessed in very graphic detail how he murdered Gary McGrath. Alan described how he plotted, then committed the murder. He describes how he did some research to find out what type of bleach would truly eliminate all traces of blood, hence why they didn't find anything in the shop.
Wow.
He even did a little test using dog blood, just to make sure that the non-commercially available bleach he found would actually do the job. I don't even want to know how he got the dog blood, but yeah. I can kind of guess.
Yeah. Aww.
I know. He also combed the city to find a good spot to dump McGrath's Dodge truck. He thought about leaving it at the airport, which is just south of the city, but thought better of that because it's, as any airport is, under high surveillance. And funny enough, the cab fare was just too expensive to get back home.
Oh my god.
You killed someone.
Stop.
And you're like, no, too much money. So he finally landed on leaving it at the West Edmonton Mall parking lot in an area he somehow figured out didn't have any like security video footage or that kind of thing. He then negotiated a suitable cab fare to take him back to his business. He says he
negotiated.
Also, I know. Like, he really couldn't let that go. It had to be a cheap cab fare. He wasn't going to do it. He says he also cleared some snow from the property to create a bit of a snow pile so that he could hide the body in it, knowing, though, he would eventually move it into a hole. But this was a hole that he had dug 4 to 5 years earlier.
For what purpose?
So he says the hole was actually dug as a grave for his daughter's boyfriend, who he had planned to kill. But then he decided not to kill the boyfriend, so he covered the hole up with plywood just in case he would need it in the future.
Okay, this guy wanted to kill anybody.
Yeah, like to me, that's like sadistic.
Yeah.
He then claims that he called McGrath over to his shop on his Antler Lake property to discuss the matter of the overdue rent balance of the $24,000. Alan states he instigated the attack against McGrath, first by headbutting him, then elbowing him to the ground. Yeah, cool guy. Then he caved in the back of his head using a lead-filled hammer.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Then he carefully duct taped the body in poly, which I assume is like plastic tarping.
Probably like polyurethane or whatever.
Oh, okay. That makes sense. The actual court document used the word poly. So I was like, I don't know what that is. And then he placed the body in that snowbank he had prepared. He then set to cleaning up the shop with that special bleach. Then he dumped the truck according to the plan that we already discussed. And then he moved the body into that hole and covered it up. So Alan was arrested and charged with first-degree murder of Gary McGrath, and the trial was set for later in the fall of 2006. Once in court, though, the story Alan told completely changed.
Yeah, it was a story like, I've just been dying to kill somebody, no. Anybody. I had this hole and I needed to fill it.
No, because now he's actually being criminally charged, so it seems like he's backtracking. I mean, maybe he was just trying to impress the gang members, but I'm going to go ahead and say now he's just trying to cover his butt.
Yeah.
So, while Alan admitted to killing McGrath, so that story he never changes, he now claims it was in self-defense.
Okay. But he started the fight.
No. Wait. According to the news story, he and McGrath were discussing the dispute in the meat shop on his property on February 7th. He was not looking for rent payment, but actually just wanted McGrath to stop the firewood business altogether. He had had enough. Alan now claims that McGrath arrived into his shop very angry and tried to attack him with a chainsaw. Pretty different story. Alan says he was blinded by the oil that was spewing from the chainsaw, and then with his eyes closed, he somehow got his jacket off and was able to throw it directly at the chainsaw, and that jammed the chain.
Okay.
He then attacked McGrath in self-defense using an aerosol can and a piece of lumber. Once McGrath seemed to stop fighting back, he cleared the oil from his eyes, but then he realized McGrath was on the floor and then realized he died. He panicked, thinking no one would believe his story of self-defense as there were no witnesses. So he says that he then cleared the snow from the property to make a snowbank to hide the body until he could figure out what to do. He ditched the truck at the mall. He then dug a fresh hole on the property to bury the body more permanently. But then later he admitted the hole was already there, but it was actually for disposing of rodents and pests and other things he would kind of shoot on the property.
Did they find carcasses of all those?
Never said. That was another thing that I thought, okay, let's see. No comment on that. Not even in the court documents. The defense team stated that the only thing Alan was guilty of was poor decision-making following the attack. But the Crown felt quite differently, and evidence showed that Alan's actions were deliberate, intentional, planned, and well thought out. The judge did advise to the jury to take note of the smoothness and the quickness of which Alan was able to conceal what he had done to determine if the death was in fact a surprise to Alan or as a result of planning. Such things would include him using the very special cleaning products that he was able to somehow already have on hand and know that it would work. Yeah, like that takes time. Getting rid of the truck and knowing exactly where to put it, concealing the body pretty effortlessly in a sequence that only took like a day. And to me, likely you, and likely the rest of the world, that smooth, quick action would not typically occur when you didn't premeditate something. Like if I accidentally killed someone, I would not be able to make any sound decision because my brain would just be like, ah, like, I don't know.
Yeah. Like, no, definitely.
I don't think I would make a good, like, I wouldn't be able to be that methodical and like.
And he priced out the cab fare.
Like he had time to negotiate a price. Anyways, after a month-long trial and 130 exhibits and dozens of witnesses, there was a publication ban. So I don't know who these witnesses were. I don't know what on earth they had to do with the crime because they didn't witness, no one witnessed him kill him. I suspect it probably involved the daughter and the boyfriend and just some stuff to kind of make the backstory. But after all that, 12 jurors debated for 12 hours over a 2-day period. And on December 22nd, 2006, they returned with a guilty verdict. And Alan was charged with first degree murder of Gary McGrath. He was then sentenced to life, which here in Canada is 25 years. So, in an undercover investigation, apparently, the RCMP and police will leave a suspect alone for a while or quietly surveil them to make them think they're not pursuing the case. This makes them feel as though they're potentially off the hook. They don't have to watch their back. and in doing so, become more careless. The RCMP later apologized to the family for not being able to tell them more throughout the entire investigations, but I think it's clear that they had to do this in order to solve the murder. In an appeal submitted in 2010, the defense very much felt that the judge spoke out of turn and not according to lawful principles, and that the things he did following the event did truly fit with the "oops, I fucked up and no one's gonna believe me" scenario. The things they pointed out in the document, though, was how the judge almost kind of prompted them to kind of really take into account the smoothness of his actions and kind of just swayed it ever so slightly to be like, you can think about X, Y, and Z, but make sure you look at this because that would indicate this, like almost a little bit like pushy.
Yeah.
In 2016, Allen, at 64 years old, applied for temporary escorted absences from the prison to visit his family at home, but he was denied. The panel stated that although he, and I quote, has behaved well in prison and has completed some counseling, he has a past history of violence and needs to gain more insight into his addictions, family abuse issues, and grief loss and other issues.
I feel like there's a whole lot to him we don't know.
There's so much more. And honestly, when I come back to the thought that he planned to kill his daughter's boyfriend and then here they mention family abuse issues, it's kind of not surprising. But I couldn't find any information on that. Because again, there was a huge publication ban like stamped on the court documents. So while we could go through the evidence, we couldn't actually hear any of the witness testimonies.
Huh.
So regardless, Allen will still be eligible for full parole in October 5th, 2030, at the age of 78 years old. So there you have it, the tale of a business partnership gone wrong. Would you do it? Would you go into business with your best friend? I mean, like,
would you kill your friend?
No, I would not kill my friend. I would not kill anyone. Hopefully our podcast partnership doesn't turn sour and you don't bury me in a hole.
Yeah, unlikely. Thank you for joining us for another episode of Beyond the Unknown. If you have a story you'd like to share, please email us at moody.mediaprod@gmail.com. You can reach out on our website, and who knows, your story might be featured in our next episode.
All of our sources for this episode can be found on our website, beyondtheunknownpod.com. And don't forget, if you enjoyed this episode, please, please subscribe and please leave us a review. We love reading them.
Please. Until next time, listeners, stay curious and remember that the unknown is always just beyond the shadows.
Bye.